12. During Colin Mandy's closing address for the defence, and at various points in Justice Beale's endless directions to us at the conclusion of the trial, we were warned that Erin Patterson could not be convicted for lying. Being proven a liar did not mean that she was a murderer, and I got that. I could tell the difference. We weren't nincompoops. Nonetheless, when it came to lying, Erin was an elite performer. She could have lied for Australia. If it were an Olympic sport, she would have been the first picked. Here's your tracksuit, congratulations. Go get a medal. But up to now, guilt had been a long way from being the only reasonable conclusion that could be drawn from her lies. Think about it. The Pattersons were her only family, regardless of her estrangement from Simon. To make sure they still cared, she wanted them to think she was struggling through a difficult time. She wouldn't have been the first human being to lie in that situation. I could buy that. Added to this, there was no identifiable reason why Erin would have been planning to kill two grandparents, whom her kids loved and saw often, and two slightly more distant in-laws, who had never even been invited to lunch before, and against whom she held no grudge. Nothing had been presented, uncovered, or revealed that gave any motive for that at all. And if there was no motive, how could there be intention? That had been the question posed at the very beginning of the trial, and it still hung over everything. Before we got to the lunch itself, I went back over all the peripheral evidence for the 2 or 3 weeks prior, just to make sure I hadn't missed anything. But there wasn't much, just some little things that had been brushed over as innocuous, but which might add up to something. On the 11th of July, Erin had put a new SIM card in her Samsung Galaxy tablet. It had connected to her mobile data network with the number ending in 835, but it was in a tablet. Okay, nothing unusual there. That just sounded like standard life administration. On the 16th of July, at 12:06 p.m, immediately following the church service at which Erin had extended her lunch invitations, Gail had texted about the next day's arrangements for the kids. "Hi, Erin. If Bronte wants to come tomorrow, that's fine. Love, Don and Gail." 2 hours later, Erin replied, "Thank you. Just to complicate things, Jack says he thinks he'd prefer it with him. I think maybe he doesn't want to compete with Bronte for your time/attention, so we'll leave it the way it is. Just Jack, and I'll drop him off about 11 to 11:30, and you can bring him home when you're done with him. He's got a key to let himself in if I'm not home." Heather confirmed that Saturday, the 29th of July, is good for them to come for lunch, so hopefully that's good for you too. Love, Erin. "That sounds good to us," Gail answered a few minutes later. "Yes, 29th of July is fine for us too." "Great, thank you," Erin signed off. Irrelevant? Well, in a direct sense, yes. But it also added yet more weight to the assertion that Erin had absolutely zero motive to kill Don and Gail. They were open and welcoming to their grandchildren, and both grandchildren clearly loved spending time with Nana and Papa, and the relationship with Erin was warm and cordial. There was nothing to see here. There really wasn't. No motive, no intention. I could not stop leaning that way merely by applying the very test Justice Beale had instructed us to apply way back at the beginning of the trial. What conclusions could be reasonably drawn from the evidence? So now we have reached Friday, the 28th of July, the evening before the famous lunch. Erin was picking Bronte up from her ballet class in Inverloch. That's when Simon texted to say he wasn't coming to lunch. She had answered from the car as she waited for Bronte. As they were driving home, Bronte asked what was on tomorrow. The way Erin told it, she said Nana and Papa and Ian and Heather were coming over for lunch, and Bronte could join them if she wanted to, or she could see if Jack would take her to a movie. Bronte loved the idea of a movie. After they arrived home, Erin was salting the eye fillet steaks for the next day's lunch to draw out the juices when Jack and his friend Barnaby returned from youth group around 9 p.m. or so. They started playing computer games immediately. Barnaby had permission from his parents to crash at the Patterson house that night, and Erin asked the boys if they could take Bronte to the movies tomorrow. What if she dropped them at Macca's around midday? They could have lunch, see a movie, and either she or Simon would pick them up later that arvo. Everyone happy? Sure, no worries. The next morning, Erin got up and took stock of what she had to do to have lunch ready by 12:30. She was in for a busy morning, she could see that. She had several beef wellingtons to make. As we'd heard, she was making individual parcels due to her inability to source a whole beef eye fillet, which, understandably enough, she couldn't find in a retail supermarket like Woolworths. However, it is worth noting, as Nanette did late in the day, that the Leongatha Fresh Meat and Fish Supplies shop was straight across the road from Woolworths, like literally 20 metres away. If Erin had really wanted to cook a proper beef Wellington, sourcing a whole beef eye fillet would not have been her toughest assignment. Making the damn thing is much tougher, and she was now making either 6, 7, or 8 of them. Due to the volume to circumference ratio, the amount of mushroom mixture she now needed had more than doubled. Luckily, though, she had bought tons of sliced button mushies and, oh, yeah, there were those Tupperware containers of dried mushies somewhere in the pantry too. She might need them. Next, she had to consider all the other layers, which had to be repeated for each Wellington. The full recipe would have required considerable planning. Make the mushroom mixture, the duxelle. Sear the beef. Cover it in mustard. Make the crepe. Spread out some plastic wrap. Lay the crepe on it. Add the prosciutto, then the mushroom mixture, then the steak. Roll it all up. Take off the plastic and put all that inside some puff pastry. Don didn't eat prosciutto, however, so she could drop that element. And Erin decided to make life a little easier by also ditching the mustard and substituting store-bought phyllo pastry for the homemade crepe. So her version of beef Wellington simply became steaks wrapped in mushies, wrapped in phyllo pastry, wrapped in puff pastry. Obviously, I haven't eaten phyllo or puff pastry in years. Nonetheless, wrapping one inside the other seemed an eccentric culinary idea, to say the least. But it was still going to be tricky and time-consuming, not to mention being a carb bomb. So she started early, about 9:30 a.m. First, the mushroom duxelle. She got out the Woolies button mushies and emptied 2 tubs of them into her Thermomix to chop them down a bit further. Then she added them to a pan with garlic and shallots. She fried them on a low heat for at least 45 minutes until all their moisture was out. As I was cooking it down, I tasted it a few times and it seemed a little bland to me, so I decided to put in the dried mushrooms that I'd bought from the grocer that I still had from the pantry, Erin explained. So I poured water over them to get the crispness out, chopped them up and, like, sprinkled them over the duxelle and pushed them in with an egg flip. And at that time, to your knowledge, quizzed Colin, what was in that Tupperware container? At that time, I believed it was just the mushrooms that I'd bought in Melbourne. And now what do you think might have been in that Tupperware container? Now I think there was a possibility that there were forage ones in there as well. After this significant admission, Colin made a sudden U-turn and changed the subject with barely a pause. He decided to take Erin back to events that had occurred 12 hours before the food preparation and ask her some further questions about her text exchanges with Simon the previous evening and her reaction to his texts. What had Erin been thinking? How did it make her feel? Then something else and something else. In the scheme of the whole trial, they were generally inconsequential questions. I didn't know if this was a deliberate tactic. Maybe I'm reading too much into it. But I did wonder if Colin had learned this art of diversion from a magician. In taking our minds away from the mushroom duxelle, it meant the natural, screamingly obvious follow-up question to the one he had just asked went begging. And perhaps we, the jury, would never think of it. Let's go back a step. You're cooking a new dish. You want to impress. You taste something a few times. It's bland. You want this meal to be special. You add something else in your attempt to punch up the flavour. Okay, fine. And then what do you do? What does any home cook do in that situation, having gone through those steps? Wouldn't you taste it again? That's what I'd do. But it's not just me, is it? All right, I grant that some people aren't tasters, and that's fine. But we knew that Erin was a taster, because she'd already said it. And if you're a taster, you're a taster. You've tried to punch up the flavour, you're worried about it. What are you thinking next? Is it still bland? Should I add more? Do I need a counterbalance? Have I stuffed up the whole thing? Where's the pepper? Surely you'd taste it again. Or perhaps the better question is, why wouldn't you taste it again? Well, if you knew it'd kill you, you wouldn't. That'd be one answer. That'd made me think twice. I was beginning to understand why Justice Beale had been so firm about telling us to wait until we had heard the whole of the evidence. If everything else pointed to Erin's innocence, I could probably just write this off as one small moment of freakish good luck. Erin got distracted by something. Bronte ran in, the dog barked. Who could say? She was just damn lucky that, for whatever reason, she didn't taste her mushroom mixture again and by the grace of God escaped an agonizing death. But if more and more of these moments were to emerge, my assessment would eventually need a recalculation. After 10 minutes, Colin wound up his cute piece of misdirection and returned to the cooking story, picking it up just a tiny bit later than where he'd previously left it. So you've told the jury about making the duxelle. He pivoted back. Yep, said Erin, offering no further detail. Can you talk us through the rest of the process? And we were off the subject of mushrooms faster than a speeding bullet. Instead, with Colin prodding, Erin trundled through all the following stages of her meal preparation. The steaks were seared, and everything got laid out and wrapped up and put in the oven at 180 degrees. To be honest, I nearly fell asleep. 15 kilometres away in downtown Corumbara on this critical morning, Ian Wilkinson was probably having porridge for breakfast. He couldn't recall precisely what he had had, but considering he said he typically had porridge all through winter, the odds were he had porridge. I'd put my money on porridge. After breakfast, he and Heather walked down the street to a local cafe and both had coffees. Then they wandered back home and by midday, they were waiting outside for Don and Gail, who were a little bit late picking them up, but not by much. They still reached 84 Gibson Street, Leongatha, by 12:30 p.m. As Don steered the car into Erin's driveway, Heather noticed something missing. Simon's car isn't here. No, said Don. He won't be coming. It's just us. No further explanation. Just that, apparently. As they approached the front door, Erin greeted them and ushered them in. It was the first time Ian and Heather had seen Erin's new house. They admired the open-plan space. The lounge room, dining room, and kitchen flowed into each other with simple elegance. Then there was a sort of TV room that could be closed off. A snug, it would have been called on the TV show Grand Designs. Don and Ian wandered over to Erin's bookcases. Erin had hundreds of books, and they began browsing through her collection. Meanwhile, Heather and Gail surveyed the various design features and wondered what had been whose idea and who had chosen the colour scheme. Heather was particularly interested in pantries because she was looking to redesign her own kitchen and was scouting for ideas. Did Erin have a pantry? It wasn't obvious, said Erin, but the pantry was behind that wall in the kitchen. Heather was intrigued. She started walking over to it. Could I have a look? She asked politely, not seriously expecting the answer to be no. Gail, curious as well, immediately started following her. But Ian saw that Erin wasn't joining them. She clearly did want to say no. She was very reluctant about this. It might seem to be a trivial moment, but Ian Wilkinson's memory of the movements and conversations during this pre-lunch period were very generalised and non-specific, apart from a couple of standout exceptions, and this was the first. Of course, because we now know what might have been in the pantry, in a Tupperware container, it was a memory of Ian's that Erin had to explain. How did you feel about them going to look in your pantry? Colin asked her during the trial. I mean mixed, she answered. Like I was proud of my pantry, but it was probably a little bit messy. I think I'd hidden my garbage bag around there or something, so yeah, but it was fine for them to go in. They just said it was great and they'd love to have a big pantry like that. According to Ian, Heather even called Ian over to have a look. But having seen Erin's initial reluctance, Ian demurred and stayed chatting with Don. They then started talking about the garden. Some work had recently been done in the garden, mulch laid, things like that, and as a group they went out on the veranda to have a look. There was some wind damage to trees down on the back fence, a few things to notice and a few things to admire. Then they all came back inside. Gail and Heather stood on the dining room side of the kitchen bench while Erin mashed the potatoes on the kitchen side. The Wellingtons were resting on an oven tray next to the stove. First, Erin served out the mash, then she added a Wellington to each plate, and then finally the beans. Ian Wilkinson was very clear that Erin did all the plating. Both Heather and Gail offered to help, but the offer was rejected, and Erin plated all the food. And what plates did you use to serve up the food? Colin asked Erin when she finally got her chance in the witness box. It sounded so ordinary, just a dull, routine question. But, oh my God, the plates. The plates had been talked about for 2 years. Anyway, at this point in the trial, Erin answered calmly. Just the dinner plates I had, so I think there's a couple of black, a couple of white, one that's red on top and black underneath, and then I've got one that Bronte made at kindergarten. Did you own any other dinner plates? Asked Colin. No, I didn't. Did you own any grey plates? He said pointedly. No, I didn't. Just to put this in context, when the police had conducted a search of Erin's property a week later, they found two black plates, one black and red plate, two white plates, and Bronte's multicoloured kindergarten plate. Erin's evidence, therefore, matched exactly what the police had found at her house. So why the fuss? Well, it was a fuss because it didn't match what Ian had said from the very beginning, and not just Ian. Heather had said the same before she died, and the press had repeated it again and again. Ian's version had long ago become accepted reality throughout Australia. As Jane Warren carefully led Ian Wilkinson through his evidence, she had to establish that he would have had a very clear view of all the meals as Erin plated them up. We had to all be sure he had seen the plates clearly, without a shadow of a doubt. They were on the kitchen bench, that bench that divides the kitchen and the dining room, and I could see them between Heather and Gail, Ian confirmed. There were four large grey dinner plates and one smaller plate, a different colour. It was an orangey tan sort of colour. What colour were the four large dinner plates? Jane repeated. They were a grey colour. Different shades of grey? Sort of a middle grey. And the smaller plate, you said, was an orangey tan colour? Yes. Of all Ian Wilkinson's recollections about the lunch, this was by far his clearest. It left an imprint from the beginning. The beef Wellingtons that he and Heather and Don and Gail had all been given had been plated on matching grey plates, and Erin's plate was different. Heather had picked up two of the grey plates. Gail had picked up the other two. Erin's last task in the kitchen had been to pour the gravy into a gravy boat, and then she had taken that gravy boat and her plate, the orangey tan one, to her spot at the table. This evidence about the plates didn't fit what the police found, nor what Erin had said. But the clarity and force of Ian's testimony were compelling. There was no doubt in the world that he believed what he was telling us. He was saying, "I'm fuzzy on a lot of details about that day, but I remember the plates clear as a bell." Having a conviction about a memory doesn't automatically make it true, and there was nothing to support Ian's testimony, except it sounded right. He'd said it from the beginning. So had Heather. Never wavered. There was just something about it. You couldn't dismiss it. But if it were true, where were the grey plates? And the orangey tan one? What had happened to them? Jane went over it again with Ian, just to be absolutely sure that we, the jury, were getting it. "Mr. Wilkinson, I just want to be very specific about this. What type of plate, from the descriptions that you have given, did you eat from?" "I ate from a grey plate." "Heather?" "A grey plate." "Gail?" "A grey plate." "Don?" "A grey plate." "And Erin?" "A rusty coloured plate. Orangey tan plate." If you'd been there and heard it, I can tell you, you would have believed it. And it would have been a riddle. Anyway, our five intrepid diners sat at the table, each with a plate in front of them. Don and Gail on one side, Heather and Erin on the other, and Ian at the end. With the food in front of them, Ian bowed his head and began a short, ancient ritual that every table in the land had routinely witnessed until sometime in the 1970s or 1980s, when it drifted out of favour. It was now in 2023, a quaint hangover from decades past, only kept alive by those of deep faith. But around this table, at least four of the five were people of deep faith. God was their saviour. For all their lives, they had put their trust in him. They had devoted their lives to him. They had never doubted the love he had for them. And as a pastor, the person among them who was closest to God was Ian, so he said grace. "For that which we are about to receive, Lord, make us truly thankful." Fucking hell. Amen.